Welcome, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Radio Network. It is 3:06, and I'm going to be joined this half hour by a very special guest, Dr. Liana Fix, who is a fellow for Europe with the David Rockefeller Studies Program with the Council on Foreign Relations based out of Washington, D.C. Welcome, Dr. Fix. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's my pleasure.
Tell us, for those who may not know, what is the Council on Foreign Relations and what do you all do?
Well, the Council on Foreign Relations is an old institution. It was founded in the 1920s. It has a headquarters in New York. And the idea was at that time to help politicians develop ideas and correct ideas about international affairs. So basically to advise with the experience of those who have studied international affairs for a long time, politicians and policymakers, which at the time, obviously, between two world wars, was a much more difficult task than it is perhaps today. And the council has a membership base of experts and thought leaders across the United States, not only in Washington and New York, but CFR members across the entire country that contribute to its activities and lead the debate on foreign policy issues. For example, on the question, what does foreign policy, United States foreign policy, do for the middle class in the United States? Why should we care about China? Why should we care about Putin's invasion of Ukraine? That's the questions we're discussing here at the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, and that's what we as experts are here for to explain.
And does the CFR have any partisan or political explicit affiliation?
No, CFR is entirely independent. It does not take government money. It is really very focused on maintaining the integrity of its analysis. So CFR has advised both Republican and Democratic governments in the past and is proud of its long tradition of bipartisanship.
Well, thank you again for being here. And you laid out one of the questions that I wanted to very much ask you. We just, in the last weeks, finally had funding for Ukraine that was adopted and signed by the President of the United States. Absolutely critical. It can be put in no other terms than Ukrainians were literally running out of ammunition. It was at truly a tipping point. Why should Americans care about Vladimir Putin and about his invasion of Ukraine? Why does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously very easy to think, I mean, there's a big ocean between the United States and Europe. Why should the United States care? That's basically Europe's neighborhood. If Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so there's no treaty obligation from the side of the United States to defend Ukraine. The problem is that Russia is not only, it has attacked Ukraine, not only because it wants Ukraine as part of its Vladimir Putin's empire, but because it really is conducting a war against the West and a war against the United States in a broader sense. So it tries to challenge the role that the United States has in the world and the interest that the United States has in the world for stability, for prosperity, for safe opportunities to trade, to pursue diplomacy. And in the past, the United States has made very bad experiences with just leaving Europeans to their own devices. Obviously, the Second World War, but also the First World War, showed that a conflict in Europe will sooner or later also affect the United States. And the concern is that if Russia is not stopped in Ukraine, it might continue and it might become emboldened to attack a NATO member, which would inevitably draw the United States into the war. So it is better to show Vladimir Putin the red lines now than to clean up the mess if he is not stopped soon enough.
You mentioned a couple of things about Vladimir Putin opposing things like stability, increased peacefulness, the spread of democracy, additional liberalization, in other words, increased freedoms for greater numbers of people, and overall increase in prosperity for regular working people, both in the United States and with our Western allies. Why does Vladimir Putin oppose these things? What's in it for him?
Vladimir Putin has an idea of Russia and of the world which is very much anchored in his own experience. He was a KGB officer, actually a quite low-level KGB officer at the time of the end of the Cold War. So his formative experience was he grew up in an authoritarian system like the Soviet Union. He benefited from the system. He thought, well, that's how you run a country, not democracy, you run it through authoritarianism. And he saw all that, as well as Russia's and the Soviet Union's empire, being shattered at the end of the Cold War. So for him, it's a personal mission to regain the power of Russia, Russia's empire, and also to regain what he liked at the time, the hierarchical system at home where opposing views are oppressed, and where it is basically the ruling elite that benefits from raw materials, oil and gas that Russia and back then the Soviet Union had. This is the system that he grew up with, that he considers the system, the best way to govern the Russian people and to live with other countries. And for him, it's difficult to understand that this is obviously not what his neighbors like Ukraine or Georgia or Moldova are striving for, that they want freedom and democracy and to speak freely and to choose freely who their partners and allies are. That is something which is for him not acceptable.
Fascinating. You also mentioned, as we've been talking, Dr. Fix, that really what the concern is, even for potentially isolationists in the United States, or those that believe we overspend in their view on protecting and engaging to support allies like Ukraine in these armed conflicts, that the longer game here, what would be truly costly at a scale we have not yet, or in the last, say, 20 years seen, would be if when Vladimir Putin would invade a NATO country if he is able to successfully take over Ukraine. That would draw the United States into war with Russia, which again would be the absolute costly in terms of potentially American lives, as well as enormous economic cost, including long-term global economic disruption as a result of that. I originally reached out to you because NATO just celebrated its 75th anniversary this past April 4th. Can you explain to folks who have heard NATO, it's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, what is that? And how is it differ from an organization like the United Nations for folks that may not be familiar?
Yeah, the main difference between NATO and the United States, the United Nations, is that NATO is a military alliance. So the United Nations is an institution which aims to govern the world in a better way, by bringing together all countries in the world, by having a Security Council where conflicts should be resolved. They often are not because of veto rights by the United States and Russia. But NATO, in its essence, is really a military alliance. So if one member of NATO gets attacked, the others come to help them. It's a very traditional concept of a military alliance, which goes back almost centuries, the idea of mutual support and solidarity. And it was so important during the Cold War because the Soviet Union had the ambition to extend its sphere of influence into Europe, which would have meant that basically Europe would, all the resources, all the prosperity that Europe had, would sort of be part of an authoritarian system, of an authoritarian communist system. And at that point, the United States made this promise, we will keep Europe free and prosperous. We have not fought two world wars and the Second World War to free Europe from Nazism, from Adolf Hitler, to let it become a prey to the Soviet Union. So that was the idea behind NATO. And obviously there was also a selfish idea for the United States behind that. Well, if we have allies in Europe that also come to our help, I mean, remember Article 5, the solidarity article for NATO members, was only applied once after the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center, when European allies came to help the United States in Afghanistan. So it's for the two, for all allies, NATO is an insurance. Of course, the United States contributes most, but it is for the United States its stronghold and its foothold in Europe.
And indeed, as you just noted, Dr. Fix, following the terrorist attacks on the United States on September 11th, NATO took a position, had a military presence in Afghanistan alongside U.S. troops for 20 years. Excuse me. So NATO has stood by its mutual defense promises, or collective defense promises, as you noted, outlined in Article 5 of the treaty itself. In addition, we've seen in the last year the addition of two members to NATO, both Finland about last year at this time, and then Sweden just about a month ago. This marks the largest expansion in NATO since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. Why the expansion now?
Yeah, it was a very quick, almost overnight decision that Sweden and Finland took. I mean, Sweden and Finland were countries that were both proud of their tradition of being not aligned with the military alliance. They would not call it neutrality, but it is something like neutrality to some extent. I mean, closer to the West, but still they're not part of the military alliance. And what I've seen in Ukraine is that Russia doesn't accept the status anymore. For Russia, it's only either you're in the alliance or you're out. And if you're out the alliance, you're possible potential target for Russian aggressiveness. And that led Finland and Sweden to really rethink their long tradition and to say, well, now for us, this idea of neutrality is over because it doesn't work, because Russia doesn't accept it. And therefore, we need to find shelter in a world and in a Europe where Russia has become increasingly aggressive. And that also explains why it is so difficult to find a political solution for Ukraine, because those who propose, well, why don't Ukraine just become neutral and then it's not anymore a problem? Well, neutrality is not accepted for Ukraine. And if Sweden and Finland wanted to become a member of NATO to be protected, it is understandable that Ukraine doesn't believe that neutrality keeps it safe.
We're joined this half hour by Dr. Liana Fix of the Council on Foreign Relations. We're digging into NATO and Ukraine and foreign policy generally for the United States. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network in just a moment. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My guest this half hour is Dr. Liana Fix of the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm so glad that you're here because so much is happening from a foreign policy or international relations point right now. And I think for so many Americans and Wisconsinites, the mechanics of international relations or diplomacy, the reasons why the United States may engage or not engage in particular assistance, support, or military alliances is sort of in this black box. And people don't understand how...
Sometimes it's for me too.
Well, gosh, I hope not, because I'm about to ask you, just at a very high level, and not in with any particular piece of diplomacy in mind, but at a very high level, what are the different apparatuses or organizations within the U.S. government? How do foreign policy or intervention or engagement decisions get made? What are the mechanics there? Who's at the table? And why don't we understand more about it? Why isn't it more transparent?
Yeah, so actually I'm sitting up the road of one of the main centers of foreign policy making in Washington, and that is the White House with the National Security Council, as it is called. It's a council where basically the main advisors to the president sit, and they work on Ukraine, they work on Europe, they work on the Asia, on the Indo-Pacific, they work on China, and their task is to coordinate the government and all the other ministries, the State Department, the intelligence services, the DoD, the Pentagon, to really have a foreign policy that every part of the government can support and can execute. It's sometimes difficult sort of to understand it from the outside, because obviously there are always different interests and trade-offs to make, right? I mean, US Treasury, the Treasury Department, will obviously always say, well, are you sure we have to do this support? Because we also have other issues to balance in our budget, domestic issues, for example. And then you have the Pentagon who says, well, but we have to think about our own national defense if we help allies. And then you have the State Department who says, well, but our alliances are so important worldwide. That's where we get our power from, not only from military power, but also from friends and partners who support our interests. So there you have sort of these clashing situations also here in Washington. And it is the White House and the National Security Council that tries to forge a sort of a clear position. It doesn't always succeed, and mostly it doesn't often succeed because obviously, and most importantly, you still have the Hill and the Congress with the House of Representatives and the Senate that, you know, have their own prerogative over foreign policy, and especially the financing of foreign policy, which is another level of negotiations. And that's perhaps the one which is sort of most prominent in the news if the White House and the Hill disagree, as, for example, on Ukraine and Israel aid. And when you have this back and forth and where domestic politics come back into play in foreign policy, which is good because, I mean, obviously, it should not only be the president who decides, it should be the representatives who have their voice, but it can lead to the situation where an issue like Ukraine or Israel support is hijacked by some members of Congress and then gets drawn out and becomes a big news item for weeks or even for months.
A really straight-up question that probably doesn't have a straight-up answer, and that is, has isolationism ever worked for the United States? Is isolationism ever a good idea? Is isolationism a good idea now?
Well, I can read the book of my colleague Charles Kupchan, who has written a book about the history of isolationism in the United States. And actually, in the most recent examples, the United States has benefited from the opportunity to establish order in the world after the Second World War, because it was able to magnify its own power globally and to pursue its own interests sort of on a global level. So isolationism really hasn't been tested in recent times, because there was such a consensus that through partnerships, the United States can form a world which is more in its interest, a more democratic world, a freer world, a more prosperous world, than it could if it just withdraws and leaves the playing field to other actors, to authoritarian actors. And certainly there are people who want to try that and to test how does a world look like with an isolationist United States. It is fair to assume that in this world we will see more conflict, because the United States is not able to impose order in certain regions. It is fair to assume that with an isolationist United States, we will also see the rise of more authoritarian powers and more power to Russia and China, who then will be unchecked to bully their neighbors in their regions. And that is a world that I personally would not like to see, and why, and especially since I'm a European by origin, value and appreciate US leadership. But I'm also sure that it's not a world that US Americans want to see, a world which is not mirroring their own system of democracy and freedom, but to the contrary, is falling prey to authoritarianism.
And at a very basic level, would it also be fair to say that in that world with an America that is isolationist and the increasing powers of dominance of Russia and China, that we would also likely or nearly certainly see greater economic uncertainty, which the biggest impacts of which would be borne by, frankly, working middle class folks here in the United States, that would have a really devastating impact on each of our economic security, if not actual physical security, in the most dire potential circumstances. Would that also be fair?
Yeah, we see that already now, that the way how China pursues, for for example, trade and economic policy is that it subsidizes its own industry, right? So it puts a lot of state money into its own industries. And if the United States sort of withdraws from the world and from the global order and doesn't really pay attention anymore to what China does globally, in the end, with all these state subsidies, China will be able to dominate all economic relationships in the globally and around the globe. We have this problem in Europe, for example, where cheap Chinese electric vehicles can basically destroy the European auto industry. And if you don't keep sort of this aggressive economic power that China exerts now in check, then it will also be, as you said, American workers and American economic interests, which will suffer, and American markets, to which America usually could export, that will, where America will lose its market share. So not only for free trade and free shipping routes and so on, but also for applying certain rules in global economic trade, the United States, it's crucial.
My last question for you, and we have just about a minute left, is what is Europe's collective response to the specter of an increasingly authoritarian and isolationist United States?
Well, I think I only need 2 seconds. Panic. No, I mean, I'll go into a little bit more detail, but it is, I mean, the United States leadership is so important for Europe. Europe doesn't have the military and the defense to protect itself. And it needs the white, the city on the hill to support European democracy. So
we're going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry to interrupt, Dr. Fick. Would you come back again sometime? This is a discussion that we need to continue to have. Thank you so much, my guest this afternoon, Dr. Liana Fick from the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about the importance of the United States' role for stability and prosperity in the world, and the importance of NATO. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. No plans tonight? No worries. Civic Media's got you covered. The Bucks will be all over our network on no less than one, two, three, about six of our network stations. Tip-off in Game 6, the crucial must-win game, will be at 5 o'clock. They'll be playing the Pacers. Go download our app for free, and you too can join in the Bucks playoffs excitement. Joined this past half hour by Dr. Liana Fick, Fellow for Europe in the David Rockefeller Studies Program with the Council on Foreign Relations. You can find her Twitter at Liana Fick. My thanks to her. What an important discussion in this moment. I've always been a bit of a foreign policy junkie, and in fact, for a while, when I lived in New York, subscribed to one of the council's publications that they pointed out. They actually put out a magazine called Foreign Relations, and I call it a magazine with air quotes around that term because it's basically a book. It is very wonky, very nerdy, and I have probably never learned more than when I would take the time to read through at least a couple of the articles in those magazines. We will definitely have Dr. Fick back on again because I think her perspective and expertise is evident and so needed in this moment. And speaking of international relations, and speaking of the topic of our first hour, the student-led protest regarding Israel's decisions and its approach to the conflict in Gaza following the terrorist attack of Hamas on Israel on October 7th. We've been talking about that. I'm going to engage that conversation again. I took the time this morning to go interview some folks down at the UWM protest, including Samia Saeed, who is the media liaison for the Students for a Free Palestine movement. We asked her some questions. We engaged. But the bridge between what Dr. Fix was talking about and, of course, Israel and Gaza and this discussion of the student protests is both obvious and had a major news development earlier this week. In case you missed it, there has been reporting by numerous outlets that the International Criminal Court may be considering issuing arrest warrants for senior government officials on charges related to the conflict with Hamas, according to at least five Israeli and foreign officials. This is a really big deal. If the court proceeds with these arrest warrants, the Israeli officials could be potentially accused of preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza and pursuing potentially an excessively harsh response to the October 7th Hamas-led terrorist attacks on Israel, including various violations of international law. It is believed that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu may be a potential target of those warrants. If you're not familiar with the International Criminal Court, this is the court that's based in The Hague. It is the world's only permanent international court that has the power to prosecute individuals accused of war crimes or genocide and crimes against humanity. Now, interestingly enough, the court has no police force of its own. It relies on its members, which include nearly all European countries, but interestingly do not include the United States or Israel, but it relies on its members to arrest those named in warrants. And that is important because the International Criminal Court cannot try defendants in absentia. The defendant must be physically present if a prosecution is to proceed. Now, interestingly enough, Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, yep, he spent some time as a prosecutor at the ICC. And don't get this confused with a separate organization or entity, the International Court of Justice, which is a different court in The Hague. Again, very different organization. This is the International Criminal Court. The International Court of Justice has already heard accusations of genocide against the Israeli state. So again, keep your eye on this space. One of the particularly practical results of an ICC charge or arrest warrant being issued for a head of state is that it makes the head of state, it makes traveling for the head of state very difficult, given that most of Europe is a member of the International Criminal Court. If Prime Minister Netanyahu was issued an arrest warrant or a warrant in his name, and he were to travel somewhere in Europe, set foot on the ground, he could then be arrested by that member nation of the International Criminal Court. Likewise for the leaders of Hamas. Hamas leaders are also being considered for arrest warrants. Karim Khan, the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, previously confirmed to the New York Times that his team is investigating incidents relating to the war in Gaza, but his office declined to comment further and said that it does not, quote, respond to speculation in media reports. Quite the development. Watch this space. But returning to matters closer to home, again, I interviewed Ms. Samia Saeed, the media relations representative for the UWM Students for Justice in Palestine organization. And I was sharing with all of us and you some of the sound before we had our conversation with Dr. Liana Fix. And potentially the most important question, or one of the most important questions that I had for Ms. Saeed was, do you support a two-state solution in the Middle East? Do you acknowledge the need for an independent state of Israel? Let's listen to me ask her that question and let's listen to her response. Kelvin, this is going to be cut number two. Mm-hmm. Do you think there can be a place where there is acknowledgement of the need for a independent state of Palestine? In other words, a geographic free nation state of Palestine, as well as one for Israel? Can that exist together?
Well, that question is, I know that question keeps coming up a lot, and we believe that Palestine, we believe that the first Nakba should never have happened. That's what we believe in. We believe that the first Nakba should never have happened. We believe that all of the atrocities that happened against Palestinians in the last 75 years, they should not have happened. We think that there is Palestine and then occupied Palestinian lands, as there were 75 years ago, everything was Palestine. We have a whole graphic down there that shows us the history of Palestine.
And do you acknowledge that there was obviously a genocide of Jewish people as led by Nazi Germany in the late
30s? Oh, of course. Okay. Of course, we acknowledge that genocide. We also acknowledge the genocide that happened on Turtle Island of the Native Americans. We acknowledge all genocides. We acknowledge all apartheid states. We think that South Africa was wrong for having an apartheid state and that system against native South Africans. We believe that America, or rather the American political leaders, were wrong for coming to Turtle Island and then killing the native populations, genocide, a whole genocide against them. We think that everything is wrong. We believe that the Holocaust was obviously a very terrible thing that happened, and it was also a genocide. So it was a genocide, and so is this one. They are both related in the sense that they are both genocide.
Very interesting response. A lot going on there. If you haven't heard the word Nakba before, it is Arabic for catastrophe. It's generally used in reference to the 1948 Arab-Israeli war and the displacement, or according to some, dispossession of Palestinians during that war. Before the Nakba, by most accounts, Palestine was a multi-ethnic, multicultural society. So again, that is language used largely by pro-Palestinian advocates. That is not my language, and I want to make that clear during our discussion that please do not attribute Ms. Saeed's words or statements to me. I'm just trying to, again, engage that conversation. That, to me, is at the root of this question. Is there a pathway to resolution where genocide isn't matched or responded to by genocide? How do we bring about a lasting peace? This is, by many accounts, not just a 75-year-long conflict, but a conflict that spans centuries. These are disputed sacred holy grounds. How do we work towards that kind of lasting peace? I found it incredibly interesting that in response to my question about whether or not a two-state solution is the answer here, that Ms. Saeed did not really answer the question directly. But I think from my perspective, my opinion on this issue is that a two-state solution is the only pathway forward. I also believe, and it is my opinion, that we can condemn Hamas. We can agree that terrorists must be held accountable. And we can, at the same time, condemn the actions of the Prime Minister of Israel if they have resulted in the killing of civilians, if the response from Israel has not, as measured by international law, been, quote, proportionate and specifically narrow to respond to the terrorist attack. Again, I do think these matters are complex and subject to international law. I am in the process of trying to schedule a friend of the show and professor of international law and law of armed conflict, Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell of Notre Dame, so that she can come help us continue to understand this complicated topic. While all of this incredibly trying discussion, protests, dialogue, and politics is going on this global stage and right here in our backyard, our state also yesterday had quite a tragedy, quite a horrific occurrence as well in the Mount Horeb School District. We have some sound from one of the parents of a student in the Mount Horem School District. I do want to take some time to take a listen on that. Do we have time to listen to Ms. Isaacson, Calvin, before we go? Okay, this is a parent of one of the students at Mount Horeb in response to what could have been a disaster and a tragedy of even higher proportions. Let's listen to Ms. Isaacson. Well, if we can, we'll take a listen to Ms. Isaacson. Not to worry, Calvin, you let me know if you've got the sound. He does. Let's take a listen again. Parent Laura Isaacson in response.
There's a shooter in my school. And I said, is it a drill? And he said, no, it's not a drill.
And
I just, it's the worst nightmare you can imagine as a mom. I think the teachers did a good job of, you know, keeping them safe, keeping them entertained, fed. So I think they just want to come home. This is a safe community with good families, and I just think if something can happen here, it could happen anywhere. I can't imagine a better place to raise kids.
That is parent Laura Isaacson, parent of one of the students at the Mount Horeb school where there was a shooter, a young male student, presumed to be a young male student in the Mount Horeb school district, who was shot and killed by law enforcement. He never made it inside the school. It's really important to point out that the superintendent of the school district, in response to yesterday, thanked the citizens of Mount Horeb for passing the school referendum that allowed them in Mount Horeb to harden the exterior entry points into schools, which the school superintendent credited with stopping the shooter yesterday. It all comes together. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Don't go anywhere because I've got to finish the Vice President Olympics. We're going to be talking about Marco Rubio as a potential candidate after these brief messages. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. And if you didn't know it already, Civic Media doesn't just do talk radio. We also have some incredible music stations. So if you're out on a jog or you're working on your spring outdoor preparations here in Wisconsin, you can check out Civic Media's music station lineup. If you're into the 80s and 90s, download and open up the Civic Media app and check out 105.7 CFW in Eau Claire or 99.7 Max FM out of Baraboo in Wisconsin Dells. We also have a country lineup. You can find our country jams on 98Q Country Park Falls, 105.5 WIRI Wisconsin Rapids, and WRCO Richland Center, all free in the Civic Media app. Yesterday, I spent the last segment of my show talking a little bit about the Cruella de Vil of the VP sweepstakes to become Donald Trump's running mate, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, serial animal abuser, adulteress, skids greaser, influence peddler, all around bad apple, I gotta say. And to top it all off, when she went to go get her dental veneer, she didn't even do it in the good state of South Dakota. She took a freebie from some cosmetic dentist in Texas. If I was a South Dakotan, I'd be offended. But it's not just about Kristi Noem, though she had been top of list for many prognosticators. It's also J.D. Vance is in the running, Elise Stefanik, Rick Scott, Doug Burgum, the North Dakota governor, and also current Florida Senator Marco Rubio. Interesting fact that I did not know until I started to looking into Little Marco, as Trump used to call him. And that is that the 12th Amendment of the United States Constitution says that if the president and the vice president inhabit the same state when the state's electors cast their ballots. So that's going to be on December 17th this year. That ticket, that candidacy could lose the electoral votes from that state. Florida's got 30 of them. You don't want to lose those if you're counting it on the plus side. And again, if you're doing the math, Florida, 30 electoral votes, that's 11% of the total number of electoral votes needed to win the White House. This 12th Amendment provision is often referred to as the favorite sons provision. Wow. Didn't know that. And this has been an issue before. Again, something I didn't know, now sharing with you. This happened with GW and Dick Cheney. They both lived in Texas. And Dick Cheney moved from Texas to Wyoming so that he could join the ticket as George W. Bush's vice presidential running mate. Now, a bunch of folks in Texas sued, but ultimately Bush Cheney prevailed. Now, that's a show for a whole nother day about how Dick Cheney was asked by the Bush campaign to put together a short list of vice presidential candidates and basically walked into the room and said, well, I think it's me. That was his short list. Name list of one, and that is me. You want to talk about self-advocacy? Hats off to Dick Cheney for not much else, but certainly for that. So this presents quite a problem because Marco Rubio is a current sitting senator. Now, generally, the wisdom around VP picks is that you want a vice presidential candidate that's from a different region of the country or that can get you some votes from that state. So he's got some minuses already lined up. But there would certainly seem to be the prospect of some litigation around this, lawsuits, but probably more troubling for Rubio as a potential vice presidential pick is that if he were to step down from his senator's seat, it would trigger two simultaneous or near simultaneous Senate races in the state of Florida, which, wow, that hasn't happened in the United States since 1936, which in that year, bizarrely, the two current sitting senators back then died in the same year, so they had two simultaneous Senate elections. But why would Donald Trump even think about picking Marco Rubio, right, with all of these potential legal double Senate races, they're from the same state, all that stuff? Well, in short order, Donald Trump recognizes that he has made some headway with Latino and Hispanic voters in the United States. And certainly Marco Rubio would be expected to deliver and help drive Trump's engagement and voter turnout from Latino and Hispanic communities even further. Marco Rubio is fluent in Spanish. And by most accounts, he appears to be the only Latino or Hispanic person on the short list for vice president. So pretty attractive from just a bare knuckle politics perspective. And for more traditional conservatives, just like Mike Pence was back in 2016, Marco Rubio would likely be pitched and viewed favorably by more traditional Republicans and conservatives. Of course, this would provide people even more of an excuse to be like, well, he won't, Trump is, won't be that bad because there's Marco Rubio. Well, we saw how well that turned out on January 6th. I mean, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to be grasping or elbowing around to be on the VP list with Donald Trump. The last guy almost got killed by an angry mob. I do not understand why that job is attractive. So that's a big deal. Now, to deal with the double Senate races, of course, Trump could try to change his residence back to New York, but he's not going to want to do that because Florida's got basically zero income taxes, and it is so Republican controlled by Ron DeSantis that it's basically like if Trump wanted to dream up a Trump state to suit his purposes perfectly, it would be the state of Florida, even though the governor thought he'd run against Donald Trump for the presidential election. But of course, as we discussed this week, Meatball Ron also bent his knee at the altar of Trump this past week. That'll do it for me today. You're going to want to come back tomorrow. We got quite the lineup of guests. Terry Barr with Local and Overlooked, Terry Bell with Media on the Media, and Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez. Don't miss it. I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it's always better when we stand together.